Hello, this is episode 14 of Allen's Eyes and Ears. I'm Professor Allen, your host. And today, we are continuing a mini-series that began with episode 2, wherein I go through my comic book collection in minute, excruciating detail. Excruciating for you, and excruciating for me. But first, a little feedback. And we start with a bit of feedback, actually, from me. All the way back on that first Eyes and Ears, I talked about some of the Jack Ryan movies, and Ed Moore recommended the Jack Ryan show on Amazon Prime and also the Reacher show. Well, when I was struck down by the COVID a few months back, it seemed like a good time to do some streaming. So what I ended up watching during that week and a half, was all four seasons of Jack Ryan and the first season of the British version of Broadchurch. Yes, I mean the good version of Broadchurch, and from what I understand, the good season. I would say that that was actually a great season. Also, I thoroughly enjoyed Jack Ryan. I said during that episode that I've read all of the original Clancy books and find the vast majority of them to land somewhere between really good to pretty great, which actually sets a high standard for any filmed version of the Clancy works. I thought that John Krasinski was cast very well in the role of the young Jack Ryan, as were many other of the roles. They really took advantage of that extended time frame to tell a long-term set of stories, giving the character room to grow, time to grow, and just delivering an all-around excellent product. Very good recommendation on the Jack Ryan show, Ed. Thank you. And I have added Reacher to the list, albeit, I'll admit, it's pretty far down the list. I want to knock out the second season of Loki first, and then I think after that I'm going to tackle Bosch. And no, I've never read any of the Michael Connelly novels featuring that character, but the show was a strong personal recommendation to me. Also, if any listener has views on which science fiction show I should move up the list, either Altered Carbon or The Expanse, let me know. As you can tell, I pay close attention and take serious listener recommendations. On the episode featuring the Puerto Rico collection, Ruth Sutherland said, "I enjoyed hearing all the details on that stealthy surprise Christmas gift that Val and Em conspired to give you. And of course, I enjoyed hearing about your December travels." Well, thank you, Ruth. We certainly enjoyed our December travels, especially the couple hours we got to hang out with you and Darren. And then we have comments from the Heroines shows, episodes 11 and 12. Roger Preeb called the first one a great episode and another must listen. Billy D also said it was a great show, although he did have one request. Next time, please don't use that sexy music to intro and outro Shag. Hashtag uncomfortable. Here's the thing, Billy. He was the one that gave us that book, so I kind of felt obliged to have him on the show, and then when we reached out, he requested sexy walk-up music. I really had no choice, you see. On the other hand, I certainly hope that you felt that that music enhanced the appearances by Dr. Ange and Luke and all the others. Sir Dr. Ange wrote in on that first Heroines episode. "I do think that moments does make you think of a singular event or scene and not a character's overall growth. But I do have a couple of thoughts about the Legion, because they are the only subject from this episode that I feel knowledgeable about. First,
the Projectra neck snap.
It's important to note that Nemesis Kid had a history with both Karate Kid and Projectra, having been a traitor from the beginning when they were initiated into the Legion at the same time. So this one had history. I'll also say that Nemesis Kid's power is to immediately have a resistance or method of overcoming his enemy's powers. So yes, he was immune to her illusions, but not to her training. A great moment. And second, Saturn Girl. I definitely concur with Mart that Imra defeating Mon-El and Ultra Boy easily in the Universo project is a huge moment and should have been included. But for me, her moment occurs in Legion of Superheroes Annual number 3, standing up to Darkseid, begging him to give her back her son, and then going to him again, gutsy. As for other moments for Legion heroines, Dream Girl being elected leader right before the Great Darkness is a moment, especially given how well she led the team during that time. And for Shrinking Violet, not so much a moment, but she went from shy wallflower to kidnap victim to more aggressive and independent, and finally being in one of the first open gay relationships in comics. She has the biggest arc of all, I would say. Great show all around. Great guests. Thanks for doing this. Thanks for all of that, Doc. Between you and Martin, all of this Legion talk has me really wanting to go back for a read-through on some of those issues. And speaking of Sir Martin, he wrote in on that second episode. Hi, Alan. Excuse the late reply. I couldn't play this episode on the cruise ship for some reason. Let me just put a pin in that right here and comment that if you were ever unsure about what exactly the phrase humble brag entails, Sir Martin just gave us the perfect example. He couldn't listen to the episode because he was on a cruise. Well, fortunately, when Martin found himself back on solid ground, on terra firma, he was able to listen, and he called it a great show. Ange, Laurel, and Luke all dropping fantastic gobbets of opinion, insight, and information. One favorite pre-crisis Supergirl moment that really should have been in the book is from DC Comics Presents number 28. That's the Mongol debut storyline in which she reminds Superman that sometimes you have to look at the big picture, and he sees War World for what it is. For what it is. It shows that Kara is her own heroine, not just as Ambush Bug believed, Superman in a wig. Supergirl's Christmas message to Deadman resonates perfectly with her earliest years when she was doing all her good deeds in secret. She did what was right with no thought of praise. As regards the question of whether Superman could originally have put Kara with the Kents rather than an orphanage, nope. They were definitely dead. They died before he went to college. I loved hearing Laurel's insights and opinions on Birds of Prey. It really is hard trying to pick out moments. I bought the original run from start to finish and always enjoyed it, but there's not much that remains in my memory in terms of big impact. There were always great relationship moments, perhaps too many to single any specific one out. Luke's chat was brilliant. I'm a big Hawkgirl slash Hawkwoman fan. Shiera, not Kendra. And there were some good alternative selections for big moments. But really, any appearance in which she punches horrible Hyathis, such as World's Finest 278, or Minxie Mavis Trent, would qualify. Bring on the next batch of relatively geeky goddesses, Martin. Thank you so much, Sir Mart. Those two episodes were definitely examples, cases, where the guests' expertise, including your own, truly made the episode. And like I said, I plan to dig back into that book of superheroines around this time next year. And social media support for those two heroine episodes came from all of the guests on those episodes. Thank you all. And also Ranger Gord from the Prairie Justice podcast. Chris from Professor Frenzy. Jamie Valdez Lopez. Dave's Comic Heroes blog. Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us. Komoda 1977. Evan Bevins. Asterix 51. Billy D from Magazines and Monsters. The A World on Fire podcast. Steve Givens from the It's a Givens blog. Bill from the Batpod. Sean from Secret Wars and Beyond. Kirk Spencer, Big Five Army. Ian Prime. Jose Ponce de Leon. The Sutherlands. Vic and Phoenix. Tim Price. The Pod Crasher. Bill McDonald. Shane Kelly. Jay Campbell. Ed from Teal Productions. Matt McKeegan. Trevor Owen Williams. James Williams from Karen. Clinton from Coffee and Comics. Keith G. Baker. Jeremiah the Notorious JJG. Bill at Spy Vinyl. Supergirl of Argo. And our good friends, the Bowling Green State University Pop Culture Studies Department. Which brings us to part two of the collection discussion. And let's start by revisiting this concept, some general info and updates before we get to that promised excruciating detail. At this point, as of this recording, I have 2,734 comics in the collection. That compares to 2,699 that I had for the first part of this coverage. So I have been going crazy the last few months on a buying binge. And actually, seriously, for me, increasing the collection by 35 comics over the course of just a few months, that sort of is a wild buying binge. I talked about The Christmas Gift, the Puerto Rico collection, on a recent episode, and some of these additions come from there, while others are actual purchases that I've made recently. So yes, a buying binge. But before we get to where we left off last time, I do have a number of updates from the first collection episode talking about changes to the collection that have occurred since then between the letter A and Batgirl and the Birds of Prey. Changes that happen later in the alphabet, there's no need for a retroactive update because we haven't covered those books yet. But last time, I talked about, I would say I agonized over, the distinction between comics that I consider in the collection officially and other comics that I own that are not in the collection. And there was one oversight there that I should mention, because it is a sci-fi property I'm a huge fan of. A somewhat controversial creator that I'm a big fan of, JMS, J. Michael Straczynski. And there are so few comic books from this franchise. The fact that I own them all should be mentioned. But the reason that Babylon 5, 1 through 11, and Babylon 5 in Valen's Name, 1 through 3, are not considered parts of the main collection is that me and M set them aside for potential podcast coverage somewhere. Whenever that does happen, or if it becomes clear that it won't happen, I will bring them down to the basement and enter them into the official Excel spreadsheet. Also, I mentioned Alter Ego, the Roy Thomas comic book, not the magazine, that I had issues 1 through 4 of that title, and that I needed to put those on the list of comics to reread to decide whether to keep them in the collection or not. Well, I just happened to be looking at the Quarterbin database recently and saw that issue one of Alter Ego is in there. So what I'm going to do is find a time, hopefully in the next few months, to manipulate. No, that sounds too negative. To adjust the randomness factor to make sure that I cover it on a Quarterbin episode. Pretty soon, actually, if the schedule holds. So I plan to cover issue one on a Quarterbin not that far from now, and then I'll also read after that issues 2 through 4, and then report back either on that Quarterbin issue or maybe over here somewhere about the rest of the miniseries, and then decide whether they are keepers or not. Another potential Quarterbin book where eyes and ears crossover is Alien Legion, because I went to the Spidey Conference at Bowling Green, the subject of episode 4 of Alan's Eyes and Ears, and they had a giveaway box of comics. And in there were 6 issues of Alien Legion, and I didn't want to be greedy, so on the first day I only took 3. And the second day, the others were still there, so I nabbed them as well and ended up with Alien Legion 7 through 12 from the Marvel Epic run. I did not put those in the database, at least not yet, in terms of the collection, because I do want to cover an issue on the Quarterbin first and then read the rest. And when that happens, I can make that decision. The problem is, as I've learned, as you all have learned, is that once a book or a run ends up in the collection, it's really hard for me to pry it out of the collection. So I want to read those ones first, at least a couple of them, again, cover one on a Quarterbin maybe, before making that call. Now, during November, aka War Comics Month, I read the one-shot DC comic Army at War from 1978. I say one shot, but it's probably more likely that this was a DC implosion situation, the reason that there's only one issue of it. But it was a good issue, and since there was only the one issue, I decided to keep it, and I added that one to the collection. And lastly, on the most controversial comic that I mentioned in that first episode of discussing the collection, I did reread Avengers 200 based on some comments about the unusual and problematic nature of the story. It is actually a common sci-fi premise, the super-fast alien pregnancy, the kid that grows up super-fast. We've all seen that before, and it is often non-consensual. Most sci-fi alien-slash-human encounters are non-consensual. I mean, of course, in fiction. In real life, aliens are well-known for their respect of all human laws and cultural mores, so that's not really a worry in the real world. But the nature of this one, and the way Carol is portrayed, her mixed feelings, everybody's mixed feelings, is just so uncomfortable. At least she acknowledges how weird the situation is and whatever emotions she's feeling, and that is something. Also, the male members of the team do let Carol make whatever decision she wants. She has some agency. But overall, the problematic elements were just hard to ignore. So I did decide that if you're only going to have one Avengers issue in the collection, this is not the one to have. And so it went away. So when I said earlier that I've added 25 comics to the collection since we last talked about the collection, well, technically speaking, I added 26 comics and removed that one. And all of that brings us to part two of The Anatomy of a Collection. And we'll get to that right after this podcast promo.
Attention all comic book fans, are you looking for a podcast that delivers the latest news, previews, reviews, and interviews on all things comic books? Look no further than Comics for Fun and Profit, hosted by two brothers, Kyle and Drew, with creator interviews by host Jason from Hawaii. With 800 episodes under their belt and a decade of experience, Kyle and Drew are true experts in the world of comic books. Their passion for the medium shines through in every episode as they share their love for all things comic-related. Whether you're a seasoned collector or just starting out, Comics for Fun and Profit has something for everyone. From classic story arcs to the latest releases, Kyle and Drew keep listeners up to date with everything happening in the world of comics. So why wait? Join the thousands of satisfied listeners who have made Comics for Fun and Profit their go-to podcast for all things comic books. With informative and entertaining content, you're sure to have a blast while expanding your knowledge of this beloved medium. Tune in to Comics for Fun and Profit however you listen to podcasts and discover why C4FAP is the ultimate podcast for comic book fans everywhere.
And we're back with our Batman phase, and probably some other comics too, because don't tell anyone, but as you're about to learn, I don't have a ton of Batman issues. More than I have Avengers, to be fair, but that's not saying a lot. So we start with Batman 496 through 524, which includes two issues of 500 with two different covers. So it's 30 issues, but a 29-issue run, because I am counting both versions of 500. And even though that makes for the largest collection of any title so far, I recognize that 30 issues of Batman is not very many. I've told you, my collection is small, and even my collection of Batman is pretty small. And Bill Beer has just erased the episode and unsubscribed to the entire network. And J. Dave and Bailey are strongly considering that option. These issues are from, you know, basically the Nightfall era, 93 to 95, and even includes issue 497, The Breaking of the Bat. I'm guessing that I have this run because of that, because of the hype of both Bane and issue 500. So Prodigal, Zero Hour, and Troika are in here, and then there's some one-offs as well. I like Doug Mensch's writing more than I like Kelly Jones's art, and I felt that way at the time as well. So by 1996, when I was getting out of most new comics, I was probably looking for a reason to stop this title. And looking back, what do you know? Underworld Unleashed, which would have been issue 525, seems to have been a good enough reason for me to end the run at 524. Now, technically, I do have a few more from this run, Batman Zero and Annual 16. That's the Eclipso Darkness Within Annual. Of these, that is probably the one, the Eclipso Annual, that is the most at risk of departing the collection at some point. And even that's not the last two Batman issues, because I have a pair from 2018 from the modern run, the Wedding issues, Batman 50 and 51. I was reading these on trade via Hoopla at the time and was really enjoying the Bat and Cat story. And at that point, we had an active pull list at World's Greatest, so I figured, why not add these issues as well? Then we have two oversized OGNs from the 90s, Batman, Seduction of the Gun, and Batman, Vengeance of Bane. Of all of these Batman books, including that Eclipso Darkness Within Annual, I think Seduction of the Gun is probably the one most at risk of a revisitation, a reevaluation of its place in the collection. And of course, there are some Batman-related titles on the bookshelf that I need to mention. Mostly, so I'm slightly less embarrassed by the low number of Batman books I actually have in the boxes. But on the bookshelf, I have, of course, Batman from the 30s to the 70s, the Mark Cadavaz book, Tales of the Dark Knight, Batman's first 50 years. In terms of traditional trade collections, I have Tales of the Demon, Batman Year One, A Death in the Family, The Many Deaths of Batman, Arkham Asylum, Spawn Batman, Batman vs. Predator, and Lee's Nobody Tells Stella, The Killing Joke. I also have both the four issues of Dark Knight Returns and the collected trade. But most importantly, I have Batman Mightfall. That's right, Mightfall, as in Batmite, my favorite imp in comic books. Well, as I say that, I need to clarify mainstream comics, because I know that the great Gazoo had his own comic for Charlton, probably. And of course, he is the greatest imp ever. But Batmite is solidly in second place. And that is actually it for the Batman title and Batman branded trades. And like I said, it's not a ton. Now, of course, these days, most issues in the regular Batman title are available in trade or on Hoopla or the DC app. So even though I have barely three dozen issues, I don't feel like there are a lot that I don't have that are truly unavailable for reading. Which brings me to some more Batman-branded titles. And it is unclear to me why I have these four miniseries here in the B section. And first up, it's Batman, Gotham Knights 1 through 4 from 1992, and Batman, Gotham Knights 2, 1 through 4 from 1995. Both of these were written by John Ostrander, and I don't have specific recollections of reading these, you know, the details of them, but I do have a general warm feeling about them. And then also Batman GCPD, 1 through 4 from 1996, and Batman Gordon's Law, 1 through 4 from 1997. Those two minis were both written by the excellent Chuck Dixon, and I covered the first issue of Gordon's Law on the Quarter Bin a couple years ago, episode 174. The basic principle for both of these series is that if you have Chuck Dixon writing crime stories with Batman family characters, what you end up with is probably going to be very, very good. And by the way, I would really appreciate it if in about 8 episodes down the road, or however long it takes us to get to the middle of the alphabet, please don't ask me then why Batman Legends of the Dark Knight is in the L's and not in the B's, while all of these issues, which should all be in the G's, are actually in the B's. So thanks, everybody. I really appreciate you not asking about that obvious contradiction. I really do not need that kind of stress in my life right now. Okay? And that finally does officially end our Batman phase, which makes it the start of our Beowulf phase. This is the DC fantasy title from the mid-70s, which ran 6 issues. And I have Beowulf 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6. I reread issue 1 a few years ago before I collected the rest. This is a title I would definitely like to finish up and then sit down and read the whole thing. Fortunately, these issues are not terribly expensive, so it's really just a matter of finding number 5 in the wild, the thrill of the hunt and all that. In that Christmas present that Em and Valerie gave me, there was a copy in there of Beowulf 1, and I already had a copy of issue 1, so I kept the one that seemed to be in better condition. Condition generally doesn't mean a ton to me, but when I have two copies of the same issue, that's really the only time I bring out the magnifying glass for compare and contrast purposes, to keep the one that is in slightly better shape. This series, Beowulf, has the reputation of being wacky, wild fun, and I definitely think that by the end of 2024, I'll have that last issue, and I can give this strange little artifact from the 1970s the good read-through that it deserves. I believe that both Dr. Ange and Tom Paneris, among other comic book buddies, are fans of this fine example of Bronze Age baddiness. And then two issues of a groundbreaking Marvel series from the 70s, Black Goliath 1 and 2. And number 1 is even signed by one of the character's co-creators, Tony Isabella. That was done at the Akron Comic-Con in late 2017, November, I want to say, when I went to that con. And in addition to having some terrific quarter bins there, I also found some cool creators. Akron is very close to Cleveland, and I don't think that Cleveland gets its due as a home for comic creators. Both historically, of course, Siegel and Shuster toiled there, but even in the years since, yes, the underground cartoonist Harvey Pekar is associated with Cleveland, but a number of other creators are from the area as well, so the Akron Comic-Con often ends up with a solid roster of guests, better than you might expect for a con of its size. So among those Northern Ohio creators, along with Mike W. Barr, P. Craig Russell, my buddy Tom Zoller, was Tony Isabella. And actually, at this con, both Tony Isabella and his Black Lightning co-creator, Trevor Von Eden, were there at the same table. This was late 2017, just a few months before the debut of the Black Lightning TV show. So they were both there promoting their work and also the upcoming show. And I did have some Black Lightning signed by each of the gentlemen, but I also slid this copy of Black Goliath 1 to Mr. Isabella for his signature. Now, I have no idea how I acquired two issues of Black Goliath. It's very possible that M was involved, at least in nabbing one, if not both. Anytime I discover a mysterious Bronze Age book in the house, there's a good chance that M was involved in its acquisition. But I am glad that I got that first issue and glad that it's one of the handful of books that I've had signed. I should mention that M has a handful of Black Lightning issues in their collection, acquired back when the Bronze Age was something they were actively uncovering. And way back in the day, I had all 11, but they did not survive one of those periodic purges of the collection. So two issues of Black Goliath, but no issues of Black Lightning currently in the collection. And then we move to one of my favorite of the war titles, even though I only own a very paltry number thereof, Black Hawk 122, 204, 212, and 252. Black Hawk 122 is one of the oldest issues I have in the collection, with a cover date of March 1958. Covered the issue on episode 62 of the Quarterbin podcast back in 2015, an episode currently available on the Quarterbin Classics feed. And I said it then, and I think it's still true. This has got to be the best quarter deal I've ever gotten. Thank you, Half Price Books, for pricing this issue at way too low a price. And I think it's true. The best places to find deals on comics are often used bookstores, because sometimes they don't know what they have. That's why you rarely get a great deal at a comic book store, because they know the difference between a book that needs its own price tag and a book that can just be tossed into a cheap bin. So anytime you hear me make that comment, know that I am specifically referencing the great deal that I got on Blackhawk 122. The other three issues of Blackhawk are just ones that I've read over the last couple of Novembers, where in combination with a decent story and a comic in decent condition, I've just decided to keep those in the collection. I don't anticipate that this part of my collection will ever be more than what it is, which is very hit and miss. No discernible pattern, no rhyme or reason as to why I have the issues that I have, except for 122. That issue of Blackhawk is a keeper. And one topic that I find myself coming back to over and over, even in the very short distance we've made it into the collection, is the independent boom of the 80s, when my LCS was in walking distance of the University of Richmond campus. That's Dave's Comics. And as I've said before, if you look at the Marvel Mega Mart ads, or whatever they were called, from this era, most of those ads have Dave's Comics listed. And from that shop, from AC, that's AmeriComics, I picked up the entire run of Bolt and Star Force 6, number one. That's it. Just number one. I have no strong recollections about this one, unlike Baker Street and Evangeline and some other of these titles. So this is one I expect to, again, pluck from the box shortly, maybe even before the third episode of this mini-series, and give it a read to decide should it stay or should it go. I mentioned the Puerto Rico collection a few minutes ago. This is the comic collection that Mrs. Quarterbin bought for me for Christmas. Most of those comics I am still going through, deciding which belong in the permanent collection and how to integrate them in. Should I read them first? You know, lots of questions like that. But there were three war books that I immediately promoted to the permanent collection. The entire run of this title was only five issues, and I got more than half of them in one fell swoop with Blitzkrieg 1-3. The hope is that by November, aka War Comics Month, I can find issues 4 and 5 in the wild at, it goes without saying, reasonable prices. And with the B's wrapped up, let's move boldly into the C's. And speaking, as we were just a few minutes ago, of the Akron Comic-Con, one of the creators I met there, Mike W. Barr, is the co-creator of an excellent maxi series, which, just like Bolt and Star Force 6, I own the entire run of. This one is slightly better known. Camelot 3000 1-12, one of the, quite frankly, and I mean this without exaggeration, one of the best limited series of all time. I covered the first two issues back in late 2022 on Quarterbin Podcast, episode 186. Rereading those two issues, they were just as good as their reputation and just as good as I remember, just as good as I expected. Excellent stuff. If you are a fan of things Arthurian and haven't read Camelot 3000 or haven't read it in a couple of decades, I highly encourage you correct that oversight. And somehow, I decided I was a fan of sorts of this next character, or a reader at least, and I somehow ended up with these two issues from the Great White North. Captain Canuck, number one, from 1975, and because one is never enough, all new classic, Captain Canuck, number one, from 2016. Now, by the way, there had been some other people filling in the role of the captain, but this 2016 series brought back the original, the greatest Captain Canuck. I know, exciting stuff. Now, just to clarify, I don't actually collect this character, except when I find a number one issue, and I find it for cheap. Sticking with captains, this one is of the Jack Kirby variety, Captain Victory and the Galactic Raiders, 1-3, from the King's time at Pacific Comics, 1981. This was one that I did not own or read at the time. It was just a bit before I was hanging out at Dave's Comics. This was one that I ran across in quarter bins more recently the last few years since I started podcasting and taking cheap comics seriously. This series ran 13 issues, and I have actually read the first 11, but for whatever reason, I've only kept the first 3 of these in the collection, probably because I didn't read them in order. I'm guessing I didn't have all 11 of those at once, so some came in and out of the collection quickly, and like I said, I just ended up keeping these 3. And again, with a pitch for an episode of the Quarterbin podcast, this time episode 116 from about 6 years ago, we covered these exact issues, Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers 1-3. So this is later in Kirby's career, obviously. And at this era, we often get big, wild ideas, but big, wild ideas that didn't always hold together as well as they might have a decade or more before. These were good, but almost more as an example of undiluted Jack Kirby, like a time capsule of sorts, than as all-time great comics on their own. But obviously I thought, and I still do think, that they are worthy of keeping around in the collection. And since we started this episode talking about DC's version of the world's greatest detective, it's only fitting that we end with the actual, factual, original world's greatest detective. Cases of Sherlock Holmes 1-7, 10-12, and 16. This title ran a total of 20 issues, the first 15 from Renegade Press and the last 5 from North Star. Over the years, there have been any number of Sherlock Holmes titles and comics produced. One of the comics at my aunt's house in the Adirondacks that I visited every summer when I was a kid was the entire run of DC's one-issue run of Sherlock Holmes. The character has fallen into public domain in a number of countries recently, making adaptations and versions and takes on the character much less expensive to produce than they may once have been, not having to pay a license fee for the character. But this one was from 1989, and it was not one that was carried by Dave's Comics. Because I'm a huge fan of Holmes, and I was back then, I definitely would have picked these up had I seen them back then. And maybe one reason the shop didn't carry this title, maybe one reason these are pretty unknown comics, is that it is unusual for a comic in terms of its format, layout. One might even go so far as to not consider it a comic book. Because as discussed in 2021 on Quarterbin 168, and I promise I really, really, really did not realize how many quarter bin references there would be in this episode. Really, I did not know. And anyway, as we said on that episode when we covered an issue of Cases of Sherlock Holmes, these are not comic books. They are, in fact, one of my favorite things, because each issue is an illustrated short story. The text of each issue is the full text of a Doyle short story, with a few spot illustrations on every page by Dan Day. The original stories adapted in these issues that I have include, in addition to others, The Barrel Coronet, The Dancing Men, The Six Napoleons, The Naval Treaty, and The Resident Patient. So currently, I have 11 of the 20 issues and would like to fill in the rest of this title as well. I run across these very rarely, so at some point I might have to visit something like mycomicshop.com to try to fill in the holes. Again, as we said, it's always more fun to hunt for these in the wild than just purchase them online. But about once a year, I do an order with my comic shop and buy, I don't know, 8, 10, 12 issues just to plug some holes. Now, for a while, before I decided to keep this, to collect this title, Cases of Sherlock Holmes, I actually had a few of the other issues run through my fingers as I read them and passed them on to other known fans of Holmes. No big deal. Like I said, I don't see these often, but when I do, they tend to be pretty affordable. The last five might be more tricky, the ones from North Star, but I'm sure I can get the rest of the Renegade issues without working too hard. So I think that's three titles mentioned in this episode that I'm actively collecting, trying to plug the gaps. Two issues of Blitzkrieg, one Beowulf, and nine Cases of Sherlock Holmes. And I believe this is a good place to end, having gone from World's Greatest Detective to World's Greatest Detective. We will get back to this topic, the anatomy of a collection, sometime down the road, maybe 2, 3, 4 months. Who knows? And in that one, we'll talk about crises and convergences, cloaks and daggers, and more. In terms of what comes next for Eyes and Ears, I am not totally sure. I do have some ideas, some thoughts, some plans. I really do just want to talk about some comic books for an episode. Certainly an episode about short story magazines or podcasts. Those are all on the list of things to do. Plenty of ideas. Ideas are not the problem. And as always, we will stick to our Eyes and Ears motto, which is, we shall see. I would love to hear your thoughts on this episode, on any or all of these comics I mentioned, as well as sending me any mockery or judgment or scorn that you believe I deserve, heaped upon me for my comic book selections and comic organization choices. I expect to have a feedback section every handful of episodes like we've been doing, whenever it naturally fits best into an episode. We value your comments and appreciate your listenership. Feedback can be sent via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Twitter or Facebook post for the episode, or directly on the blog. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. All are welcome. Thanks for listening, and take care.